Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. Every single day, your cells are basically in a state of constant crisis management.
That's a good way to put it.
We're talking about potentially hundreds of DNA double-strand breaks, DSBs, happening in every nucleus.
It sounds completely catastrophic.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, these breaks are also essential. They drive some really key biological processes.
Like our immune system, right? Generating all that diversity.
Exactly. It's the ultimate cellular balancing act. I mean, DSBs are fundamentally toxic, but they're also necessary. If the cell fails to fix them correctly, or fails to fix them quickly enough,
then you're in real trouble.
You are. The result is genome instability, which is pretty much the direct highway to cancer or some very severe neurodegenerative disorders.
And this gets magnified in the clinic. When we treat cancer with radiation or chemo, we are betting everything on one principle.
We're betting that we can cripple the tumor cells.
Right. We're overloading them with damage because we're hoping their ability to repair their own DNA is already compromised. We're weaponizing their own broken machinery against them.
And the core molecular dilemma for the cell in that moment is choice. When a break happens, what does it do?
Does it go for the gold standard, the, you know, high fidelity repair?
Or does it just try the quick and dirty, error-prone method to stick the ends back together? That choice right there determines whether the cell lives, dies, or, well, turns cancerous.
So that decision, that toggle between accuracy and speed, is governed by this incredibly complex molecular matrix. So let's unpack this. What happens when one of the primary repair factors is, say, knocked out?
Does the backup team step up?
Or does the whole system just collapse? We're diving into a study today that shows this relationship isn't fixed at all. It's surprisingly, and I'd say sometimes maddeningly, nuanced. It depends entirely on the specific job the cell is trying to do.
So today we're celebrating the work of the team at the Beckman Research Institute of City of Hope. That's Kayla Mockins. That's Lee Cisneros Aguirre, Felicia Wednesday, Lopez Colorado, and Jeremy M. Stark.
And their research gives us this essential precision, this clarity on our molecular maps that govern how broken DNA ends are handled.
Which is absolutely foundational to understanding genome stability and, crucially, to refining targeted cancer therapies.
Okay, so let's ground ourselves in the basics for a second. Chromosomal DSBs are the most severe form of DNA damage.
Right. And they can happen naturally, like you mentioned, during antibody maturation in our B cells, or they can be induced by, you know, external factors.
So the cell has two primary repair options on the table.
Option one is homology-directed repair, or HDR. This is the high-fidelity one because it uses a template.
Usually the undamaged sister chromatid.
Exactly. It uses that to perfectly restore the sequence. This is the pathway the cell prefers for accuracy, but, and this is a big but, it can only be used during the S and G2 phases of the cell cycle.
Because that's when the sister template is actually available.
All right. And then there's the focus of today's deep dive. And joining, or EJ.
This is just while ligating the broken ends together. No template.
Which is necessary, especially in G1 phase when there's no sister chromatid. But it is often, well, a lot messier.
So who's the main crew for this end joining?
That would be the canonical non-homologous end joining pathway, or NHEJ. This pathway is critical for repairing blunt DSB ends. The primary factors are DNA PKCs, along with Ku70-Co80 and XLF.
And DNA PKCs is the big gun here, right?
It really is. It's a kinase that helps bring everything together and sort of kickstarts the whole repair process.
But then competing with this pathway, or maybe coordinating with it, is this other key damage response factor, 53BP1, and its partner, RIF1.
Yes, and 53BP1 is recruited incredibly fast to the break site. Its main known function is a kind of gatekeeper role.
A gatekeeper?
Yeah, you can think of it as a massive speed bump. It actively suppresses HER, particularly by blocking the initial molecular processing of the DNA ends, a process called resection.
What exactly is resection?
Resection is when a complex called MRE11 starts chewing back the DNA strands to create these little single-stranded tails.
Which are needed for HDR to even start?
Precisely. So by blocking that resection, 53BP1 basically forces the cell toward the faster template-free EJ pathway.
Okay, so we have DNA PKCs driving the main NHEJ pathway, and we have 53 BP1 RIF1 suppressing the competing HER pathway. The core question, the real ambiguity here, is how do these two forces, DNA PKCs and 53 BP1, actually interact?
Are they working together? Are they fighting for control?
Or does one just cover the other's shift? That's what these researchers set out to clarify.
And to figure this out, they didn't just look at genetic loss, the standard knockout approach. They also used pharmacological inhibition.
With a specific drug, right?
Yes, they used M3A14, which is a highly precise inhibitor.
Yeah.
It only targets the kinase activity of DNA PKCs.
And this dual approach, comparing removing the protein entirely versus just silencing its activity, that's crucial. And we'll see why it leads to one of the most surprising findings later.
So the researchers used three highly specific assays to measure what actually happens after the break. First, the EJ7 GFP reporter.
And what does that one measure?
It specifically measures no indel EJ, so the most accurate form of end joining, where blunt ends are put back together perfectly without losing or adding any nucleotides. It's a measure of high-quality efficiency.
Got it. Efficiency. And the second tool.
The second tool, the M-EDEL assay, was all about investigating quality control. They induce specific breaks, and then they sequence the repair products to see what kind of mutations the cell made.
To see how messy it was.
Exactly. And by analyzing those deletions, they can track something called microhomology usage. These are short, repetitive sequences that the cell uses when it's really desperate.
When accuracy is no longer an option.
Right. High microhomology usage is a huge red flag that the cell has resorted to the most error-prone, sometimes called the most toxic backup pathway.
And then the last assay.
Finally, they use the LMNA-HDR assay to confirm the frequency of the high-fidelity HDR pathway and paired all of this with clonogenic survival assays.
Which gives you the direct link back to chemotherapy and radiation. How well do the cells survive?
That's it.
Okay, let's get into the results because this is where the relationship between 53BP1RIF1 and DNA PKCs gets genuinely complicated. They looked first at that most precise repair outcome. No indel EJ efficiency.
And surprisingly, they found that losing 53BP1 or RI1 alone had, well, virtually no observable effect on this precise end joining.
So the main crew, DNA PKCs and its partners, were handling it just fine on their own.
They were perfectly sufficient. And here's the critical switch. When they combined the loss of 53BP1RIF1 with disrupting DNA PKCs,
using that inhibitor drug M3A14.
Right. They saw a significant further decrease in repair efficiency. We're talking about an additional 1.8-fold drop in efficiency in the 53BP1 knockout cells that were treated with the inhibitor.
Wow. So that's a textbook example of a synthetic interaction, isn't it?
It is. The fact that losing both is dramatically worse than losing just one proves that 53BP1 and RIF1 are acting as a necessary backup.
So they're normally dispensable.
Totally dispensable. But when DNA PKCs is compromised, they step in to promote the synapsis, which is the physical act of bringing those broken DNA ends together for a ligation. They are the secondary repair crew.
Okay, that makes perfect sense for efficiency, but the story changes completely when we look at the quality of the repair.
Yes, specifically those error-prone microhomology deletions measured in that M-EDEL assay.
What happened there?
Well, when 53BP1 was knocked out on its own, it immediately caused a dramatic shift toward error-prone repair. You saw a significant increase in deletions that use microhomology.
The two and three nucleotide ones.
Exactly, and a decrease in the cleaner deletions.
And here's the really fascinating part. Disrupting DNA PKCs, either genetically or with the drug, caused an almost identical parallel shift in those deletion patterns.
So both 53BP1 loss and DNA PKCs loss steer the cell toward these really toxic microhomology deletions.
Okay, but listen to this. When they combined the 53BP1 knockout with the DNA PKCs disruption,
Right.
what happened?
The effect was not additive. It did not get any worse.
Wait, wait. The combined result was basically the same as losing either one of them on its own.
Essentially, yes.
That feels like a massive contradiction. For basic ligation efficiency, they act as a backup system for each other. But for suppressing these error-prone deletions, they act like teammates, co-conspirators.
How can two proteins have two completely different genetic relationships depending on the metric you measure?
Exactly.
That non-additive result is the key piece of evidence. It proves that for suppressing these toxic deletions, they function in the same pathway. They are hitting the same molecular switch.
They're redundant suppressors of that dangerous backup pathway.
Precisely. You only need to lose one of them to unleash that dangerous microhomology repair.
So this means we can't just talk about 53BP1 or DNA PKCs as having a single job description.
Right.
It's not that simple. They're dynamically negotiating the repair outcome in real time.
Exactly. And the dynamics become even more interesting when we look at the clinical metrics, like HDR frequency and radio sensitivity.
So as expected, 53BP1 loss increased the high-fidelity HDR pathway by over fourfold.
Which confirms its role as that gatekeeper blocking resection. No surprise there.
But the real insight comes from how DNA PKCs behaves. Genetically losing the DNA PKCs protein only caused a sort of mild 1.3-fold increase in HDR.
But inhibiting its kinase with that drug, M3814.
That caused a massive 2.8-fold increase in HDR and a huge hypersensitivity to radiation, a 14.5-fold increase in cell death at 1 Bri.
This distinction is so critical for drug development. Simply inhibiting the enzyme's activity is a vastly stronger driver of cell death than removing the protein entirely.
So the physical presence of the protein and its active function have distinct, separate effects on the cell's fate.
They do. So why would an inhibitor be so much more potent than a genetic knockout?
This must be where we connect back to that MRE11 complex, the one that initiates reception.
That's the hypothesis. The researchers suggest that when DNA PKCs is genetically lost, the cell kind of adapts. But when you inhibit the kinase using M3814, the physical protein might get stabilized on the DNA ends. It gets stuck.
In a kind of substrate trap.
A trap that still blocks the full NHEJ process. But crucially, it leaves the ends available and maybe even triggers enhanced activity of the MRE11 complex.
So this forced stabilization would accelerate resection, massively boosting HDR and severely messing with the cell's ability to choose any accurate form of end joining.
And that complex interplay means that M3814, especially with radiation, achieves massive cell killing through multiple mechanisms all at once.
You're decreasing high-fidelity blunt end joining.
You're increasing those toxic microhomology deletions.
Yeah, and you're forcing a switch toward HDR pathways that might not even be available or successful in certain tumor cells. It's a triple threat.
It really is.
So if we synthesize all of this, the model is perfectly contextual. For the mechanics to just bringing the ends together, the synapsis DNA PKCs is primary.
And 53BP1RIF1 are the backup.
But for quality control, the role reverses. For suppressing that switch to dangerous microhomology deletions.
They're co-conspirators. They share the same functional step. You only need to lose one to compromise the quality of the repair.
This research completely changes how we should view these repair pathways. They aren't static lanes on a highway.
Not at all. They're a dynamic network where the genetic interaction between two critical nodes changes based on the repair problem at hand.
What are the limitations here? What's the next step?
Well, the primary limitation, as the researchers stress, is really understanding the exact nature of the M3814 effect versus the knockout. If we don't fully get why kinase inhibition causes such profound radiosensitivity, then clinical deployment is risky.
We need to know if that stabilization hypothesis holds true in people.
We absolutely do. This entire deep dive shows us that disrupting a single molecular mechanism is never simple. It's a dynamic negotiation between pathways, and the efficacy of our drugs will depend entirely on how many backup systems are still active in a patient's tumor.
That's the key.
Knowledge is most valuable when it's understood and applied. What you really need to take away from this is that DSP repair factors, 53BP1, RIF1, and DNA PKCs, operate with context-dependent genetic interactions.
They toggle between functioning as a necessary backup system for DSP and synapsis and working together in the same pathway to maintain genome integrity by actively suppressing those highly error-prone microhomology deletions.
So the provocative question is this. What does this mean for personalized cancer therapies where disrupting a single repair mechanism might lead to vastly different outcomes depending on which backup systems are still active in a patient's tumor cells?
Understanding that context, that's the key to targeted, successful treatment.
That's everything.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now, stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.
tortured scene, holding fast to what the cells redeem. Every loss becomes a cause.